Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Spotty Dog. Yay. We're here today to celebrate the launch of a new book by a local author, Tony Fletcher. We're really pleased to have him back here. Tony's the author of several books. He's written biographies of Keith Moon, R.E.M., and the wonderful book, All Hopped Up. I know that's not the complete title, Tony. I don't have my fact checker here. All Hopped Up and Ready to Go, which is a history of New York music. Good. And so Tony's here to talk about his new book, A Light That Never Goes Out, The Enduring Saga of the Smiths. He's written a big, fat, heavy, authoritative book about this beloved band. And to help celebrate, he's brought a couple of musicians to play Smith songs, including Terry McCann and Stephen Bloom. So, welcome.
Thank you very much, Karen. It's a thrill to be here. This is one of my favorite places going. I mean, what more can you ask for? Books, beer, art supplies, kids' store, good people. I mean, it's everything you want. I just came down. We're going to start. What I'm going to do is read a bit, and then when we have a song coming up, I'm going to read about that song so that you get a little bit of a flavor about the Smiths. So rather than me just doing one 20-minute section and the guys just playing two or three songs in a row, we're going to do song talk. We'll try and give some time. If any of you feel you have questions, I'll try and allow some time at the end for some of that. And of course, I guess there's the usual signing ceremony at the end if anybody is here to buy a book or has bought one and wants to have it signed. I do want to say before we start, and I think the title of the book is appropriate, and the song that Terry and Mike are going to start with is appropriate. I'm sure everybody in this room was greatly affected by yesterday's events. I know I was. I'm a parent of a young kid who's here. I'm also on my school board. My friend Terry here is a teacher, and I know from the school board level that we are effectively helpless against a situation like this, because if people or persons are hell-bent on this kind of destruction, there's very little that we can do, and having buzzers at doors is not sufficient. It's the problem is not certainly with the schools and their desire for safety of the children. That is not where the problem is in society. So one reason we're starting late is I just went up the road to the 7th Street Park, and they're having a candlelight vigil right now, and I wanted to just take a few minutes there. I lit this particular candle and I brought it back down, and it's kind of extra cool because our elementary school at Phoenicia had a craft fair yesterday where the kids get to make Christmas presents and holiday presents and Hanukkah presents. And actually our little boy got hurt in the playground yesterday, so we had a call from school anyway, but I went in and made the toys and the crafts on his behalf. So this candle kind of comes from an elementary school. We're going to try and make sure it doesn't go out, so I took one from the candlelight vigil, and if it looks like it's going to go out, we'll light this one. And with that, I would like to welcome Terry and Michael to play this song. But I would just like, before we start, I would like us just to take a minute of silence just to pay our respects, if you all would please. Thank you. Thank you.
It's to see people that I wish I can lie. Driving in your car, I never want to go home, cause I don't got one anymore. Take me out tonight, I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home. And if a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if a 10-ton truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take me out tonight. Oh, take me anywhere, anywhere. I don't care, I don't care. Climbed up underpass, I thought I got my chance to come at last. And then a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't die. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home. And if a double-decker bus kills the both of us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if a 10-ton truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. There is a light and it never goes out. There is a light and it never goes out. There is a light and it never goes out. There is a light and it never goes out. There is a light and it never goes out.
Thanks.
Which way are we going to step around?
Talking of lights going out, I may actually need the light up just a little bit. whoever has the light, so they don't mind, just turn up. That's good. Thank you very much. So, okay, I'm going to start reading from the book. I know this is a cafe and it's a bar, but I would ask people to pay attention. If you need to have a chat, just step outside for a few minutes. This is something we've been very much looking forward to. I'm assuming that that people here do know the Smiths and understand the resonance and the legacy, and that this song that was just played, which is sort of something like 27 years old, is still a song that appeared in a movie just a few years ago as the kind of key line of the movie. But I also know I have one friend in the front here who doesn't know the Smiths, so I'm going to start off reading the opening section, the introduction, and then I'm going to jump into a part about early about the group, and then I'm going to get to the next song that these two play. I'm not going to give the backstory about that particular song. So this is the first three pages of the book. Hopefully it kind of gives you a sense of what's entailed. It takes a particular confidence for one unknown musician to pronounce to another that their first meeting has the hallmarks of legend. But then Johnny Marr, 18 years old when he arrived uninvited at the Stretford home of Stephen Patrick Morrissey one afternoon in May of 1982, had such confidence in abundance. What he did not have, and it was the reason he had come knocking on the door of the nondescript semi-detached council house at 384 King's Road that day, was a partner for his singular talent on the guitar. Stephen Morrissey, let me just get this right, I'm sure I can do it this way. Stephen Morrissey, a writer of speculative merit and a singer of absolutely no repute whatsoever, managed but sporadic bursts of self-assurance. Though he had been a figure about town since punk rock had exploded in Manchester with a special vigour back in 1976, and was respected, even liked, for his quick wit and bookish intellect, he frequently retreated into a shyness that, as he later penned with devastating certitude, was criminally vulgar. Unlike Marr, who seemed to be on first-name terms with almost everyone involved in Manchester street culture, Morrissey could count his friends on the fingers of one hand. He lived on King's Road with his divorced mother. He was unemployed, by choice for sure, but unemployed all the same. He was turning 23 that month. By any standard measurement, time appeared to be passing him by. Aware of Morrissey's shyness, Marr did not show up alone. He was accompanied on his mission by Stephen Pomfret, a mutual guitar playing acquaintance whose presence was perhaps justified by the painfully long time it took Morrissey to descend from his bedroom to the front door. But once Pomfret had made the introductions, then Marr, not known to waste his time on trivialities, announced that he was on a quest for a singer and lyricist, and Morrissey, not previously known to accept strangers into his life at first glance, promptly invited the visitors in. The trio ascended to Morrissey's bedroom where, amidst a life-size cutout of James Dean and shelves laden with books on feminism, film criticism, and crime, there stood the requisite record player and a collection of neatly filed 45s. Marr, whose encyclopedic knowledge of popular music was arguably unrivaled among Mancunians his age, immediately gravitated to the vinyl. And Morrissey, whose own outspoken opinions on the form had seen him ascend from letter writer to concert reviewer with the weekly music papers over the years, invited his guest to play something. If it was a test of taste, if it was a test of taste, Johnny Marr was thrilled to take it. The singles were heavy on the 1960s girl pop that he himself had been busy accumulating on recent trips to secondhand stores. The sort of music he hadn't dare assume anyone else in his vicinity followed with quite such a passion. Bypassing Sandy Shaw and the Shangri-Las, much though he liked the British pop star and especially the New York girl group, he instead pulled out a rare 1966 flop single by the Marvelettes on Tamla Motown. It was an American jukebox copy with the center hole punched out, and it didn't specify the A-side. So rather than play Paperboy, which had the traditional up-tempo Motown feel, Marr put on its flip, You're the One, a slower Smokey Robinson composition, and then sang along to prove that he knew the song, that this was more than just a cute gesture. Morrissey was impressed. Marr later said that he felt this was the moment that initiated their friendship. The pair talked excitedly for the next couple of hours, Stephen Pomfret fading into the background, aware that for all the talk of him as second guitarist in their future band, he was already superfluous to requirements. Morrissey and Marr, so different in age, dress sense, and social skills and various other interests, quickly bonded over that which they had in common. Music, a journey that took them from the present day back to Patti Smith and the New York Dolls, then to David Bowie and T-Rex, to the Stooges and the Velvet Underground, and on through 60s girls pop to a love for rockabilly advertised by their matching retro quiff haircuts. As they sat there in Morrissey's bedroom, they spoke of seeing their own names on a record label, not just as artists, but as composers. That Morrissey had but a handful of half-formed lyrics currently to his name, or that Marr had never completed the song to his own satisfaction, mattered little. They could sense in each other a shared sense of purpose and dedication, of craftsmanship and intellect. To borrow a phrase from more of their influences, Lou Reed describing his and Andy Warhol's work ethic with the Velvet Underground, neither of them was kidding around. Johnny Marr had a reference point all his own for their meeting. He had recently watched a documentary that detailed how, way back in 1950, a 16-year-old lyricist had knocked on the door of a fellow teenage pianist with a view to forming a songwriting partnership. The pair had gone on to become one of the most successful in popular music. It was the account of this unscripted meeting that had given Marr the inspiration to visit the mysterious Morrissey in the first place. And so he couldn't help himself. "Hey," said Johnny, "this is just how Lieber and Stoller met." So that's the first part of the intro, and then we go into, I go into talking about the Smiths' legacy and how the likes of the movie 500 Days of Summer kind of based its romance around the line from that song, "There is a light that never goes out." And then I take 200 pages before the Smiths form. There's plenty of the background in the book there, background about Manchester and about Morrissey and Marr's previous bands. Because really the thing is, when the Smiths formed, they formed fully formed. This is one of the amazing things about the band. They didn't do like 18 gigs and then work their way up from support slot. They did 2-3 gigs and people immediately said they were the best band in Manchester. They did 5 or 6 and they had a record out. By the time they did a dozen, by the time they'd been, basically a year after Johnny Marr knocked on Morrissey's door, they were the hippest band in Britain. Very, very rarely happens like that. That's why there's 200 pages up front. So I'm going to jump in now to a part shortly after they met. So that was the introduction. Then I do the whole period that builds up to that point where they meet. And shortly after they've met and they've written their first songs together. Early on in the process, Morrissey suggested and Marr agreed on the name for their band, The Smiths. Fans and critics alike have searched high and low over the years for explanations, and they are easy to come by given that Smith is the most common last name in England. But that, really, is the only explanation that was ever needed. By calling themselves the Smiths, Morrissey and Marr asserted themselves as commoners, everyday working people. In doing so, they additionally disassociated themselves from the outlandish names that were so pervasive at the time, be it in their own musical world, Echo and the Bunnymen as the big northern rock band, Quando Quango as the latest factory act, or that of the new romantic Blitz Kids hitmakers, Duran Duran, Haircut 100. And in the process of choosing a single-syllable, definitive article name, they were subscribing to the lineage of British rock legends, The Who, The Stones, The Kinks, The Clash, The Jam, and so on, and the possibility that they might eventually be considered part of that rich tapestry. It was, in short, a pronounced return to basics at a time when pompousness was dominant. Having settled on a moniker, begun writing songs, and drawn up something of a game plan, the next step was to solidify the lineup. Stephen Pomfret, as acknowledged matchmaker between Morrissey and Marr, was invited to early Smiths rehearsals in Bodham, but his presence, he felt, was requested more out of duty than desire. "Johnny never wanted another guitarist," he quickly concluded. "If I'd been the greatest guitarist in the world, I wouldn't have been in the band." He stepped back without any evident bitterness, accepting his minor role in history with grace. That still left the need for a rhythm section. For a bassist, Johnny Marr returned to the Decibel Studios and recruited Dale Hibbert, who had engineered the Freak Party session. Freak Party was Johnny's previous band. Hibbert had never been in a band of which he wasn't the leader, and he had one going at the time. It speaks volumes for Johnny Marr's powers of persuasion that Hibbert nonetheless allowed himself to be talked into quitting this band before he had even met Stephen Morrissey. Hibbert considered Marr a good friend, knew him also as a really great musician, and knew even more so that Marr seemed to have the connections to make a band happen. And when you'd been in as many bands as Hibbert had, where nothing ever happened, that was a strong selling point. When he came over to Bowdoin to meet Morrissey for the first time, Hibbert was pleased to find that as vegetarians and Velvet Underground fans, they shared common ground. Over coming weeks and months, Hibbert would frequently give Morrissey a ride home to Stretford on the back of his motorbike. The relationship was pleasant, but, as so often the case with Morrissey and people who didn't fully subscribe to his worldview, distant. "I thought he was a reasonable guy," said Hibbert, "but there was nothing that stood out about him." If there was a surprise, it was that the first song Hibbert was presented with, recorded with just vocals and guitar to Marr's TIAC 3-track Porter Studio, was a cover version, a long-forgotten single by early 1960s New York girl group The Cookies, "I Want a Boy for My Birthday." Ostensibly, this was no more risque than Ringo Starr singing the Shirelles' Boys with a Straight Face on the Beatles' debut album, a record that had also included their version of the Cookies' biggest hit, Chains. And certainly it was intended in part as a nod to the New York Dolls, who'd incorporated the Shangri-Las into their own live set. The recording itself was none so upbeat as those reference points, however. Though Morrissey faithfully replicated the lead melodies, he sang such traditionally romantic couplets as "I want a boy to comfort me and treat me tenderly." His voice was no match for the Cookies or Gene McCrae. And though Marr laid out his template for the Smiths across his two guitar tracks, neither was he on the level of Jerry Goffin, the original song's producer, nor Goffin's wife, Carole King, its arranger. At best, the Morrissey-Marr version of I Want a Boy for My Birthday was a purposefully camp presentation of a classic piece of very early 60s sexual stereotyping, which is why it would have made some sense to Dale Hibbert when he was duly informed that the Smiths were going to be a gay band. Interestingly, Johnny Marr claimed this idea as his own, a result of his and his friend Andrew Berry's and John Kennedy's nocturnal habits. As Berry, who was straight, noted the Manchester's dire early 80s nightlife, "We worked in the centre of town and the only bars that were open would be gay bars. The notion of the Smiths as a gay band then," said Marr, "was just because a lot of my mates were gay guys who liked rock music. I liked the idea of us being a band that were saying things for the gay community." Gay imagery was becoming more prevalent in popular music for those who were searching for it, in the frontmen of the chart-topping acts Soft Cell and Culture Club, for example. And yet the social climate was still sufficiently repressive that no pop act, including those two, was ready to risk its career by unequivocally coming out. Within the Smiths, Dale Hibbert already had a daughter by his girlfriend, and Marr was in a long-term relationship with Angie Brown. There was no way they could position themselves as a gay band without putting the entire onus on Stephen Morrissey. And in hindsight, Marr recognised that dilemma. "I wasn't fronting the band, so it wasn't on my toes," he said. The idea was dropped for the time being. The quest for an image, though, remained paramount, with the new monthly style magazines proving so influential that the weekly music papers were now following their lead. A new band needed to have some sort of inherently contrived look to stand even the smallest chance of media attention. Hibbert was sent to the Army Surplus store on London Road to acquire himself some bowling shirts, and then to see Andrew Berry on Palatine Road for a flat-top haircut. The harder acquisition was a specific type of second-hand denim jeans with a belt loop for a work tool. At some point over the next couple of months, the three-piece spent a day being photographed around Manchester in these clothes. The session never surfaced. The decision to now record a demo tape before settling on a drummer was not a difficult one. It was part of their bill-building-like plan that they should be seen as songsmiths. And besides, with Hibbert working at Decibel, the session would cost them nothing. Drummer Cy Wollstonecraft, who'd been in Freak Party with Andy and Johnny, despite instant reservations about the name The Smiths, and despite Marr's warning that the band was totally different from Freak Party, agreed to fill in and showed up at the beginning of August to record Suffer Little Children and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle without having previously heard the songs or met the singer. The act as it existed was short on experience and practice all around. Morrissey, in particular, had not seen the inside of a studio in 4 years, and his natural singing style at this point was considerably lower in timbre, tone, and especially pitch than it would need to be for the Smiths to become a success. Both Smith songs recorded that day would eventually be tuned up a full step to accommodate Morrissey's limited range. Johnny Marr sang backing vocals on The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, a contribution he would soon abandon, and Morrissey exercised a vibrato effect on his own vocals, clearly trying his best to demonstrate his capabilities as a fully fledged singer. In addition, they engaged in some intriguing experimentation on the song Suffer Little Children. As the song drew to a conclusion on a repeated minor chord, Morrissey's friend Annalisa provided cackles, which someone else whistled along while someone else whistled along casually. A cassette recording of Johnny Marr playing piano in waltz rhythm recorded at Bowdoin was spliced in, along with a separate recording of local elementary school children at play, which Marr had recorded through his open window at home. The recordings show definite signs of promise, but they were no more than an introductory statement, a mere hint at the band that the Smiths would soon become, with a different rhythm section. Yet, as with almost any new young band in its first demo, there were no such reservations from within. Marr took to playing it at the clothes store he worked at as often as he could get away with. Morrissey lined up an appointment to play it for Tony Wilson, the Factory Records founder. Cy Wollstonecraft, however, felt that his inherent fears about Marr's new group had been confirmed upon meeting and working with the singer. Quite simply, he said of Morrissey, "I didn't like the cut of his jib." The vocal mumblings and evident shyness, as far as the drummer was concerned, went hand in hand with his choice of long overcoat. "There was a term for that kind of music at the time," said Wollstonecraft, "the raincoat brigade. Looking at your shoes. Ordinary. Not very flash." Wollstonecraft wanted no part of it. "It wasn't jazz funk. I was funky Cy." Wollstonecraft's objections were echoed throughout the subsequent long and arduous search for a permanent drummer. Bill Anstey, who had been in bands alongside both Marr and Hibbert, came over to Marr's house in Bowdoin, played along to some songs, and was asked his opinion. Upon comparing them to Velvet Underground, he heard an exasperated Morrissey respond, "Oh no, not another one." Older than the others, the former Sister Ray drummer was losing the hunger for the various hassles that came with being in a gigging band at the bottom of the ladder, and he told Marr as much as he packed up his kit. Marr clearly was at the opposite end of the exuberant spectrum. He was just in love with the entertainment game and the people in it, and oozed in optimism for his new band, said Anstey. Marr even showed Anstey the phone book belonging to his landlady, Shelley Rhode, who was a TV presenter and writer, full of almost everybody you've ever heard of in the TV record industry. And the drummer was left feeling that, to Johnny, this was all he believed he needed to get where he was going. But still, Anstey refused to join the group. "I would have had a total personality clash with Morrissey if I'd stayed around," he said. "I didn't like the music they were playing, especially the lyrics." Morrissey now suggested as drummer one of his neighbours and former St. Mary's sufferers, that St. Mary's being the name of his Catholic school in Manchester, Gary Farrell, who had just left the band with fellow Kings Road boys Ivor and Andrew Perry. He had Johnny Marr call Farrell and ask him over for a meeting. If Farrell thought that process odd, given that he'd often walked home over the Iron Bridge from school with Stephen Morrissey, he found the demo tape he was subsequently handed even more so. Unable to get anything out of it, he declined further involvement. Despite living on the same road, he and Morrissey never talked again. "I think he felt I'd insulted him," said Farrell. Hibbert brought in the drummer from the Adorables, but that didn't work out either. Through mutual friends in Altrincham, a drummer named Guy Ainsworth was invited along to the trio's rehearsal space. Ainsworth walked into what he called a tense atmosphere. Though he recognised Marr's talents immediately, he otherwise allowed himself to be scared off. "There was a strange dynamic in the room," he said. "I couldn't put my finger on it." Even when the Smiths found their man, Mike Joyce, of course, it was not without initial trepidation on the drummer's part. Joyce recalled that when he showed up for an audition at Spirit, Morrissey said very little. He just kind of prowled round the room, had a long tweed coat on, and just walked up and down. A couple of furtive glances over at me. I felt as though he just thought I was stupid. I just felt a little intimidated by him. This could have been because of the four people in the room, the drummer and the singer were the only ones who didn't already know each other. Joyce was acquainted with Marr from both X-Clothes and the Club Legends. He lived in Chorlton with Pete Hunt's closest friend, which is how he'd been told about the vacant drum stool. And in his previous groups, Joyce had frequently shared the stage with Dale Hibbert. Any paranoia on Joyce's part might also have been due to digesting some magic mushrooms on the way to the studio. When he compensated for oncoming hallucinations by hammering the hell out of the drums to a new Morrissey Marr song, written in the attic room in Bowdoin, called What Difference Does It Make, that was fortuitously heavy on a Keith Richards riff, the others were taken by his energy, as well as his balls for daring to show up high. Over coming weeks, as it was ascertained that Joyce's parents were working-class Irish Catholic immigrants just like theirs, that he had attended St. Gregory's Grammar School with Andrew Berry, that he was roughly their age, and that in addition to being an outgoing, effusive, enthusiastic sort of person, he was genuinely handsome and photographed well, Morrissey and Marr had every reason to believe they had found their man. History would, at least until Mike Joyce sued them in High Court in 1996, prove them right. So that's that early section, and bear with me. This is now about the song that Terry and Mike will come up and play in just a moment. So the Smiths have now made their first album. It's been a roaring success. They've released a single since the first album, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. That's been a great success. So they're clearly at the point that they realize they're not a one-hit wonder, not a one-album wonder, hopefully not, and certainly not a flash in the pan, and they're gaining in confidence. By rights, the release of a quality post-album single, that would be Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, should have been enough to allow for time off. If not for good behaviour, then certainly for good deeds. But Morrissey and Marr recognised that they had been handed their moment, that they should act on new songs as they wrote them, rather than putting them aside for a future album. In this regard, they saw the Smiths as a throwback, not just to the furious work rate of the first generation punk bands, but to that of Marr's 1960s icons, the original rock groups who frequently stopped into studios between gigs on tour and emerged with historically important 45s. "Musically, I felt quite boundless," Marr recalled of that immediate period after the first album. Andy Rourke, the bass player now, felt much the same way. "At that time, we felt invincible. We could do anything." Unlike early days, said Marr of his latest compositions, I wasn't looking over my shoulder thinking, how is this going to sound in the Hacienda, which is the Manchester nightclub, but how is this going to sound in our fans' bedrooms? A lot of that comes with the confidence of having the backing of your audience, he said. In the spring of 1984, he and Angie, successfully reunited after a brief breakup over New Year in New York, had followed Morrissey to live in London, renting a flat in the genteel Georgian terraces of Nevin Square. The Earl's Court location was not a great distance from Morrissey's home in Kensington, but it was sufficiently far for the distractions of central, far from the distractions of central London nightlife that Marr was able to maintain his workaholic lifestyle when not otherwise on the road or in the studio. In a mammoth attempt to compile multiple musical ideas, Marr recorded several instrumental songs onto his Porter studio at the start of June. Morrissey then added enough words to two of those ideas that, in July, when the group went into jam studios with John Porter, they formed the basis of the most productive single session of their careers. Of the two, William It Was Really Nothing, unveiled at the Jobs for a Change festival earlier that summer, had already been pegged as the A-side. It opened with a flamenco-like flourish of competing acoustic guitars, an intro as short as the original version of This Charming Man. It then set out to see if it could cram several dozen chord changes, multiple guitar parts, both electric and acoustic, and an entire kitchen sink drama into just 2 minutes, and succeeded quite marvellously. Lyrically, it conjured up images of the classic 1963 British movie Billy Liar, in which Tom Courtney had played an undertaker's clerk called William, with a penchant for fantasy and fabrication that somehow failed to deter him from attracting the opposite sex, most notably the sophisticated Julie Christie, for whom the movie served as her big break. Morrissey's immortal line mid-song, "Would you like to marry me? And if you like, you can buy the ring," could have been delivered by the foul-mouthed cafe waitress Rita, whose determination to capture William Fisher in marriage offered a frighteningly vivid reminder of the loveless social contract at the heart of too many young working-class families of